Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. As my regular listeners will know, we devote a great deal of attention to the events of 9/11, the pivotal event of the 21st century, according to the President of the United States, and on that particular point, I think no one would disagree with him. In this case, today I have an extremely interesting guest who's had quite a lengthy odyssey in terms of his thinking about the events of 9/11. From a scientific point of view, he's been especially interested in what happened to the Twin Towers. His name is Frank Greening, and he worked for 23 years as a research scientist for the largest nuclear electrical utility in Canada and became involved in the study of hydrogen embrittlement of zirconium pressure tubes. This was a major problem and concern for the Atomic Energy of Canada, I think its laboratory, Frank, the designer of the Canadian reactor. Let me invite you in to tell us more about your background, Frank. It's a pleasure to welcome you to the Dynamic Duo.
Thanks, Jim. Pleased to be here.
Tell us more about your background, Frank. Did you go to school in Canada? I take you're a native Canadian?
No, I'm a Brit. I was born in London, England, and I lived in Wales. My parents were Welsh. My dad was a Welsh miner. But I went to London University, and I came to Canada in 1968.
University of London?
In London, England, yeah.
Yeah, but University of London?
No, in Canada it was McMaster in Hamilton.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've spoken at the University of London before and the London School of Economics. I love London. It's a great place. I just wondered when you said London University, whether you meant University of London?
Well, it's King's College London.
Oh, King's College. Terrific. Yeah. I've spoken there too. That's excellent.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So I came to Canada to complete my studies, and I did a PhD at McMaster, and from there I went to Ottawa and I studied with the Nobel Prize winner Gerhard Hertzberg in spectroscopy. And then for various reasons I wound up back in Europe for a while, and eventually I came back to Canada in about 75, and I needed a job, and I got a job with the electricity utility Ontario Hydro in their research lab.
What was your PhD, Frank?
It was in physical chemistry, in spectroscopy.
Okay, terrific.
And then the Hydro hired me to do analytical chemistry, and they kind of threw me into the deep end, and before I knew it, I was working on everything. It was a great job because I had so many different things to work on, from coal, ash, to oil. But eventually, all the work seemed to be in the nuclear area, and I moved into the nuclear area, and I started working on things like feeder pipes and pressure tubes, and basically as a kind of forensic scientist looking at they'd bring me a pipe with a deposit, and they'd say, "What's this deposit?" And I'd analyze it, and I'd say, "Well, it seems to be this, that, or the other." So then I worked in that area for 20 years plus, and got very heavily involved in zirconium and problems with zirconium.
And I take it at some point in time you discovered some problems internal to the operation of the reactors or whatnot in a cover-up. Could you tell us about that?
Well, I didn't discover the problem. The problem was already there. The big issue with zirconium is that it picks up hydrogen and it makes the metal brittle. And it's, therefore, it's a big concern that it doesn't pick up too much hydrogen. But they had that happen in a unit of Pickering, and it cracked the tube, and there was a loss of coolant accident, and therefore they became very sensitive to the issue of hydrogen in zirconium, and they wanted to know how and why this was happening. And the ACL guys came up with that's Atomic Energy of Canada in Chalk River, which is a separate entity, but they were working on this too, and they decided it was coming in from the outside of the pressure tube, and they had some theory, and my work was showing that this theory was incorrect. And one of my colleagues was collecting data on these samples, and I found out that they were cooking the results. They were adjusting the numbers to support the theory. And I had the fortunate experience of meeting a very good scientist at the university where this work was being done, and together we kind of cracked the code. We broke into the computer code and found out where the numbers were being altered. And we reported this to, you know, everyone, and I just met a brick wall of resistance and denial, and I was basically told to shut up. And I tried to publish it, and I was, they threatened to fire me for attempting to publish it. I was barred from just about doing anything, and this dragged on for about 5 years. So in the end, I finally came to some kind of agreement with them that I'd take early retirement. So hence I retired in about 2000 and got a small pension, and that's that story. Still not really resolved in my mind, but...
May I say that the performance of a whistleblower is what's technically known as an act of supererogation. It goes beyond the ordinary call of duty. It's like a Marine who throws himself on a hand grenade to save his fellow Marines. So I greatly admire what you did there, Frank, and it seems to me that that kind of attitude of trying to get things right and expose the truth is just what we need in the 9/11 research community. I think you might have done NIST a lot of good if you were there, although perhaps you would have suffered exactly the same fate.
Well, I think it, I mean, this sort of thing happens all over the place. It happens in industry. I think, like, it's well known, for example, in the pharmaceutical industry, if you get a grant to study the performance of a drug, you better come up with positive results, or you won't get any more research funding. So researchers, you know, are under pressure to get the right results. But, you know, the right results are not always the right results. They're the results that the company wants or the organization wants. And if you get bad results, i.e. embarrassing results or controversial results, they might try and suppress you. And I think this happens everywhere, and it's a crying shame. And I think it's a big problem in science, in industry, and in government. And unfortunately, the universities are party to this.
The Bush administration has been running a virtual war against science. It's really shocking. What do you believe were the major considerations in seeking to suppress your findings?
Well, first of all, one of the words that was kicked around by my superiors was, we must have consensus, Frank. Consensus was the buzzword, which means that the story that was prepared and presented to the regulatory body had to be agreed to by everyone, and you were not allowed to deviate from that story. You were not allowed to be a dissenter. So I think that was the problem. I was the dissenter.
Good. We'll come right back to this issue. We're talking with Frank Greening, my special guest today on the Dynamic Duo. This is your host, Jim Fesser. Today my special guest is Frank Greening, a research scientist of 25 or more years experience, especially in the area of physical chemistry, who has had some extremely interesting experiences in relation to the Atomic Energy of Canada Limited. Frank,
yes.
You were mentioning about the desire for consensus, but of course the question becomes, what's the motivation for achieving that consensus? I mean, if we turn to 9/11, obviously NIST is under tremendous pressure from the Bush administration to provide an account that supports its political position. And I just wonder what you think was the principal motivation in the case of the Canadian situation. Could it be financial or economic?
It was probably a whole bunch of things.
Yeah, real quick.
I think mainly...
Go ahead, I got my guess on.
My company needed to explain why the hydrogen was so high to the regulatory body.
Thanks, sorry.
And the story they came up with was plausible.
Right.
But it was just that. It was a story. And I felt like it wasn't the truth. And so I think in my case, it was the pressure to come up with a plausible story that would cause the least fuss, because my version of what happened was not quite so pleasant. There were, I believe that the gas was coming in from the outside, but it was due to corrosion. It was due to the ingress of moisture. It was due to the generation of nitric acid. And it was not a very pleasant picture. It raised more problems. In fact, one of the engineers said to me, "Frank, we bring you one problem, you solve it, but you create 10 more." So he was like, you know, we don't, like, stop digging was the message I got. We've got a story that's good enough for the regulators. Let's just run with that. And I was like, but it's incorrect. It's not true. It's just a story, and we should be honest. We should tell them what we really think, what we've really found. But it opened a can of worms.
It was going to be an expensive problem to repair. It implied there were serious defects in the basic mode of processing,
and basically perhaps a design flaw in the reactor. So it was not good news.
Is it something that could potentially lead to a catastrophic failure?
Well, probably not, but it was something that would cost a bundle of money to repair. So when you said, was it economic, I guess in the end it probably was. They would rather run with a reactor and sort of say everything's under control and we can live with this problem. I mean, they did make changes. They retuned the reactor, in actual fact. But then there were other problems. I saw this thing happening again and again. It was an ongoing series of problems, and an ongoing kind of patch up, they even had the regulator change they had a requirement for leak detection, and when they couldn't meet that requirement, other than fess up to it and say, okay, we have a problem, they got the regulator to change the requirement. And the regulator was in bed with the company as well, which is a whole other story.
Frank, this is so like what goes on in the United States, you know, like with the Food and Drug Administration or the Department of Agriculture. I mean, it's just shocking in relation to food processing and pharmaceuticals. We have exactly that relationship, and it's become, I think, 10 times or more worse under the Bush administration, because it's really bending all the laws, all the rules, all the procedures to benefit the short-term profit maximization of all of these corporations.
Yes. I would say, though, I do believe the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission is a little bit better than the Canadian, believe it or not. That's my opinion, but anyway...
Well, you know, it always surprises me, because I have for so long looked to Canada as a model, as exemplary in so many respects, as a society, for the quality of life, for your preoccupation or concern for your environment. And every time I hear a story like this, it's very disillusioning to me, because I already know these things are true of the United States.
Well, Canada's not far behind, and Canada likes to portray this image of being clean-cut and honest and no corruption, but it's just as bad up here, I believe. It really is.
What drew you into research on 9/11?
Well, I think, who wouldn't be interested in 9/11? It was, I remember I was in at the library where I live, and someone behind the desk said that planes just crashed into the World Trade Center, and I'd been to New York, I'd been up the World Trade Center, and I was like, what? He said, yeah, apparently it's on TV. So I hurried home, and then I watched it, like we all did. And, I was riveted. But then I was distracted at that time, because we're talking 2001. I was still in the middle of the tail end of my battle with my employer. And I didn't really get back to it until about 2003. And then the more I looked at it, the more fascinated I became. And I felt this is just ripe for scientific investigation. So I started digging into it, and I started, you know, reading all the documents I could get my hand on, you know, and sort of following it. So it was a gradual process, but once I got into it, I couldn't put it down.
Of course, even the idea of the planes hitting those buildings is suspect all on its own. It turns out that experienced pilots, such as John Lear, whose father designed the Learjet, has performed attempted simulations with other pilots, I take it, at 500 miles an hour to try to hit those buildings, and five times out of six they were missing the building, which may be not too surprising. I mean, they're less than 100 yards wide.
Yes.
But still, you know, there are suspect features of the official sequence of events right from start.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a million questions around all the events of that day, including the World Trade Center 7 and the Pentagon and so on. But I just got drawn to the Twin Towers, and I felt that you should be able to sort of figure out this collapse process. You should be able to do some calculations. You should be able to figure out, was that physically possible? So I know about all these other issues, but I felt that the collapse of the towers themselves was the most amenable to researcher with my background, as let me say. So I tended to focus on that.
Yes. And I was rather fascinated by a recent post you put up on the James Randi Educational Foundation Forum, the JREF, you usually refer to it as, where you were talking about the three main theories to explain, and I hear I would substitute the word the destruction for the word collapse of WTC 1 and 2. So what we'll do, Frank, is pick up there when we return. Today, my special guest is Frank Greening, a research scientist with over 25 years of experience, especially in Canada, in relation to issues of physical chemistry. And we're talking about his views, really the development of his views about what happened to the Twin Towers on 9/11. Frank, in relation to your post there on the Randi Forum, I was just noting, you know, that in relation to the initial sentence, at the present time, there are three main theories that claim to explain the collapse of WTC 1 and 2. I was just observing that a more neutral term, I think, would be devastation or destruction, since an awful lot of the collapse wasn't. It was rather a kind of pulverization or dustification or what have you, where the materials, the concrete flooring material, the steel, the desks, the furniture, the computers and so forth, and even human beings and living things were being turned into very fine particles. So would you not agree that a more neutral term, you know, collapse is of course the NIST official way of describing it, and they're implying some kind of floor by floor pancake kind of collapse, however it's supposed to be initiated, or a failure of the trusses as an alternative that's supposed to yield the same result. But wouldn't you agree that the gross evidence is overwhelmingly against anything like that?
Well, I would agree that there was an incredible amount of devastation and destruction. And there was pulverization of concrete as well as the gypsum wallboard and the insulation and so on. The way I tried to model it was via the kind of pancake collapse, nonetheless, because I do believe that that's still the underlying process. I mean, even in the controlled demolition idea, it still is bang, 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 bang down the tower. It's still a floor dropping onto a floor below, and then the results of that impact are, I guess, what we're talking about. So in terms of, you know, I've tried to look at the energy budget, and the energy budget is there, just barely so, but especially for the North Tower, because that was the smaller upper block. But the way I see it, that was still 58,000 tons falling, which is like the mass of the Titanic, the ship, the Titanic, falling onto the mass below. Falling 3.7 meters at 12 feet, so that's where I was a sledgehammer.
Well, let's come back to this. I mean, if you want to adopt any conception of what happened here as involving a pancake scenario, as you're suggesting, then it seems to me that Building 7 provides a wonderful contrast case, because here you had a 47-story building that unquestionably was brought down by a conventional mode of demolition, and you wound up with something on the order of as much as 5 to 7 floors of debris. And yet, if you contrast that with what was left of the World Trade Center Buildings 1 and 2, even in some of the initial photographs, compare it with, say, Building 6, which is only 8 stories high, you don't have even 8 floors of remains from 1 and 2. In fact, it's surprising if you have even 1 floor from World Trade Center 1 and 2, which seems to me to render any scenario involving a pancake collapse indefensible, because it's contradicted by the most basic evidence.
Well, I don't entirely agree with that, Jim. A marvelous book that I have to spend a lot of money to purchase is Aftermath. Have you seen that book?
No, tell me about it.
Well, but it's a collection of photographs.
Yeah.
And it's in chronological order, and the first few pages show an enormous rubble pile, because they started chipping away the debris very, very quickly. And a lot of photographs were taken, say, 10 days to a month afterwards, and already the pile had been reduced considerably. The first couple of photographs hammered home to me that the pile was enormous. I'm talking about the pile for buildings 1 and 2.
Well, this is very important, because we're talking about some of the most basic evidence here. Now, Judy Wood, of course, on her site, Dr. Judy Wood, drjudywood.com, has an enormous variety of photographs that are related to the devastation of the towers. And from my study of those, it appears that the rubble pile from 1 and 2 was overwhelmingly less than from 7. Now, you're suggesting the opposite. When you say enormous, can you give a quantification? I mean, how many floors worth of rubble do you surmise there was?
Well, above ground level, I'd say it's sort of like, 7 or 8 stories, 60 feet or more. And the other point with the World Trade Center is the huge basement, the huge underground area, the bathtub. And that could hold quite a bit of the rubble and give the illusion of a small rubble pile, when in actual fact a lot of it was sort of already half buried because of this enormous basement area.
Well, you know, I mean, the Building 7 had a very substantial sub-basement area, too, including, of course, those two massive electrical generators the building was erected around, and yet we had clearly 7 floors of rubble there. I mean, if you assume proportionately that the 7 floors from 47, you should have something in excess of 14 or 15, I would think, from 110-story buildings. So wouldn't you want to suggest that the sub-basements were absorbing more of this material?
Well, I'm saying, I don't know how far down the basements went in Building 7, but they went down 6 stories in the World Trade Center, and that, I believe, it accounts at least to some degree for, you know, this supposed anomaly of there was no rubble. I mean, there are people who make posts that, like, there was no rubble pile, and that's ridiculous. And the other issue is, well, what was that million tons of material they shipped away? Where did that come from? The idea that the buildings vanished or were turned to dust, I don't think it's strictly true. I think that's not supported by the fact.
Well, I would imagine you've seen some of the photographs showing lower Manhattan enveloped with this massive cloud of dust that includes millions of cubic yards of dust. I mean, where do you propose that came from, if not from the building?
Well, of course it came from the building, but if you've got to consider the mass, because that dust, the U.S. Geological Survey's own numbers were, it had a density of 0.3 grams per cc, which means it's very light and fluffy, and therefore it's very deceptive to say that the dust was, say, 2 inches deep. Yeah, it's 2 inches deep, but you work out with a density of 0.3 grams per cc how much that really is. When it's compacted, it's not quite so much.
Well, Judy did calculations that if you assume that the 110-story, the amount of material in the 110-story buildings was, say, 10% of the total volume that it would have produced, like an inch deep dust over 2.5 square miles, which seems to me to be not a, you know, a pretty good rough approximation. Although, I mean, part of the building wasn't turned to dust, to be sure, but I'm fascinated that you think perhaps most of it wasn't.
We'll
be right back with my special guest, Frank Greening. Today I'm discussing 9/11, and in particular the destruction of the Twin Towers, with Dr. Frank Greening, a research scientist of a great deal of experience in physical chemistry. Frank, let's return to this issue of the rubble pile and the aftermath of the destruction of the Twin Towers. Do you have, are those photographs available online somewhere we could all take a look without purchasing this fantastically expensive book?
Yeah, well, the author is, I got it here, his name is Joel Meyerowitz. And I think he has a website with a few of them, but unfortunately, I haven't seen some of the ones from, the early days of the, you know, recovery operation. But they're the best pictures I've seen.
May I presume that you have visited, Judy and Morgan's site at drjudywood.com?
Of course, yes, I have.
Yeah, and you're telling me then that the photographs in this book show a much more substantial residue of debris than those that are posted on their site.
Yeah, we're only talking about a handful of pictures, but I think in Judy Wood's case there are a handful of pictures too, really, from which you can estimate the size of the rubble pile. And you went over those numbers that Judy's worked on. I've done similar calculations. I get slightly, I reach different conclusions.
Uh-huh.
Another source that I've used is there's a company called Risk Management Solutions, who are like insurance appraisers.
Okay.
And they put out a nice description of the dust and debris as a function of distance from ground zero out. And if you take the numbers and plot them, you can kind of get a nice curve of the depth of the dust as a function of distance away from the towers. And you can play around with that and get estimates of the amount of dust. And I get, you know, that it's relative, it's not by any means all of the building was turned to dust. I mean, first of all, we know the steel, most of the steel was there in the columns and the, you know, the box columns in the pile, and there's photographs of massive mounds of those columns at Fresh Kills landfill site. So this idea that the steel was somehow vaporized, if any was, it would have been a very small percentage. We're talking, say, 1% or less.
Let me ask a couple of preliminary questions before we pursue this. One is, would you agree that the intricate lattice structure and sophisticated load redistribution capabilities built into the towers made it such that even the impact of 767s hitting the building, which were very comparable in their properties and their fuel loads and so forth, the 707s that the buildings were designed to withstand, where the 707s even had a higher cruise speed, had a negligible effect on the structural integrity of the buildings, number one?
Well, I wouldn't say negligible. I'd say, they actually, in terms of the sort of global damage, because they only damaged a few floors, but the damage they did to those floors was pretty severe. It was like a big gash. It's like a wound in the side of the building.
Yeah, but you know, Frank DeMartini, who is a project manager, described the impact of even multiple planes as analogous to sticking pencils through mosquito netting. And of course, we have the visible effects of the building. They showed some shuddering from the impact, and then they adjusted and redistributed the load, and they continued to stand without any serious consequences other than very localized ones. Are you presuming that a lot of the core columns were destroyed by these plane impacts?
I would imagine so. I mean, this is one of the problems, that a lot of what happened was inside that structure where we couldn't really see. But it does seem to me that a large part of the wreckage of the plane wound up on the kind of opposite corner to the building. I think that's what we see in the corner of the 81st floor, I think it is, of the South Tower, was that the plane kind of plowed right through the building, because it sort of disappeared, as we all know, and came to rest right across the other side. Now, I guess it was shredded along the way, but I'm sure it did terrible damage inside, with like things like the undercarriage and the engine. They're very massive objects.
Is there anything you find the least bit disturbing about the way the planes disappear into the building?
I must admit that was kind of alarming, but I don't buy anything close to the idea that was, you know, there were no planes or any of that stuff. I think those planes plowed in. I think the outer shell of the building was relatively flimsy, like the analogy of the screen, you know, and it just sort of ripped.
Would you concede that if exact study of the photographic record displayed anomalies or even physical impossibilities, or there might be something wrong with the film footage, even if flaws in the film footage would be consistent with planes still hitting the building?
Well, this is why all of these questions are very interesting, but, you know, as a scientist, I tend to, like, avoid them, like the plague, because they are... You know, you get into a lot of what-ifs, and I don't think they're amenable to sort of scientific analysis.
Frank, I mean, this is a simple conditional. It's an if-then sentence, I said. And there's nothing unscientific about it. I said, if an exact study of the photographic record displayed anomalies and even physical impossibilities, that would still be consistent with the possibility that planes had hit the buildings, but wouldn't that be disturbing?
Well, it would, but Jim, there's no such thing as a physical impossibility, because I get tired of seeing people saying the laws of physics were suspended, because they can't be, because physics is physics. It means we're misinterpreting.
That's the point, Frank, of saying the laws of physics would have had to have been suspended, when you and I know full well that laws of physics can't be violated, can't be changed, and require no enforcement. So when people say that, they're merely being figurative as a way of disabusing one of belief in any theory that requires that the laws of physics be violated.
I agree, but I'm saying that I haven't seen that kind of anomaly. I thought, to be honest, when I first saw the buildings collapse, I was like, wow, that's incredible. That's impossible. Like, what is going on here? That's what got me going on my calculation.
Uh-huh.
And I was quite surprised when I found, and I know it's just a calculation, it's just a model, but it showed that kind of momentum transfer and build-up of kinetic energy was physically possible.
Well, we'll get there, Frank, but I want to get a couple steps out of the way first. Would you not agree that most of the fuel in those planes was burned up in the massive fireballs and therefore only existed for 10 or 15 seconds, and what was left was a relatively minor residue where the fires burned in a very random or asymmetrical pattern? There was nothing uniform about it. That the temperatures of those fires were far too low to even weaken, much less cause the steel to melt.
Wow.
We'll be right back with my special guest, Frank Greening. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Stand by. Frank Greening, a research chemist with a great deal of experience. And, Frank, I'd just like to observe before we continue, lest I forget, that it seems to me a study of a photographic record is a very important subject. I have myself witnessed videos, some from helicopters, for example, showing what appeared to be a cruise missile heading toward the building. I've seen other videos that showed what appeared to be a hypersonic plane flashing by the building. I have seen other videos showing the planes heading toward the building, and yet others taking it from the same perspective, showing no plane headed toward the building. And I just would like to know whether or not you would agree this is a legitimate area of inquiry by itself, even if you yourself are not interested in pursuing it.
Yeah, I think it's legitimate. I've seen, I think, one of those with that, what you call a hypersonic plane whizzing by the towers when no plane of that description was supposed to have been there. I have seen that.
Not to mention, of course, that Rick Siegel's footage, which was he took himself, shows a rather large assortment of helicopters around the buildings, which is a very peculiar phenomenon all by itself. But, you know, Frank, I spent 6 or 8 years working with some of the best people studying the whole movie of the assassination of JFK, and it proved to be a very serious matter, because if you assume that the film is authentic, then you get a timeline for events of the assassination that runs about 6.8 seconds or so for the official scenario of 3 shots to take place. We discovered, in fact, that the film was a recreation, that they'd taken original footage and used optical printing and special effects to put together what we actually have available now, but that they made some mistakes, that they'd taken out a very important sequence in which the driver pulled the limousine to the left and to a halt in order to make sure that the president would be killed, and that it turned out that we were exposing the logical skeleton of the cover-up. Because if you assume the film was authentic, then try and try as hard as you might to reconstruct the actual sequence of events, it would be impossible to do that because you began with a false premise. So, you know, you're not in the position of having been engaged in that kind of research, but I actually have a book I published on it entitled The Great Zapruder Film Hoax, one of 3 I published of collections of studies by experts on different aspects of the case.
So yeah, I read your Murder in Dealey Plaza.
Oh, wonderful, Frank. It's terrific. I'm very happy to hear that.
Yes. So I was, in fact, your name was, I knew of you long before 9/11, of course, through those books. Because my dad was, he read one of the very first books, Rush to Judgment, by William Manchester.
Mark Lane.
And he was a very skeptical about the Warren Commission report and all of that. So, yes, I am very familiar with your work in that area.
Oh, excellent. That's excellent, Frank. Well, listen, let's return to the Twin Towers. It seems to me, and this is right in your area of expertise, if the melting point of steel is approximately 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit, and if the highest temperature a jet-based fuel fire can obtain under ideal circumstances is 1,000 degrees below that, about 1,800 degrees, obviously the fires didn't cause the steel to melt. I'm sure we can agree on that.
Yeah, well, that is one of the mysteries. Of the part of that I've latched onto recently, I like to call it the mystery of the spheres, is that fine spherical particles of iron keep showing up in the World Trade Center dust. And I believe Stephen Jones, I've talked to him about this. And that one I get excited about, because the stories of the people seeing it in the rubble pile and the rivers of molten metal and all that, that's all well and good, but there's only a handful of photographs, and there's not very much sort of scientific data per se. No one took samples, unfortunately. So I don't know what to say about those stories, but the spherical particles of iron that show up in the dust is evidence for the melting of iron or steel. And that's very strange.
Very strange indeed, because it's not obvious how at least the official scenario can possibly produce any such result. Would you not agree?
That's right. Well, the NIST fire simulations certainly couldn't get anything much above, say, 1,000 to 1,200 degrees C. So that's just not enough to melt iron or steel.
I think even Thomas Eger of MIT has agreed that the fires burn much too low. I believe the estimates are around 500 degrees Fahrenheit, apart from a few spots where they got up to 1,300 or 1,400 degrees Fahrenheit. And to have caused this field to even weaken. Would you agree that Underwriters Laboratory had certified this field to 2,000 degrees for several hours without suffering any adverse effects?
Well, yeah, but I do believe that some weakening of the structure probably occurred as the result of the fires. I'm not willing to sort of just say that didn't happen, and that's very, very crucial to the NIST model.
Are you aware that John Skilling, a senior partner in the engineering firm responsible for the towers, observed in like 1964 that they could carry some 2,000% greater than their expected live load? That's 20 times more than they were expected to have in the way of people and furniture and all that.
I think that quote has been a little bit misconstrued. I don't, because that would imply a safety factor of 20. And engineers usually work with safety factors of 2 or 3 or less.
This was an extraordinarily innovative design. We have a tube within a tube. It's an extremely robust structure. The 47 core columns in the rectangular arrangement provide a remarkable strength for the building, even if the 9/11 commission somehow neglected that massive support structure and said that the center of the buildings were nothing but a hollow space and staircases and elevators.
Well, that's partly true, but the other aspect that it goes the other way is this idea that it was trusses. And I think one of there's a Vincent Dunn, the fire chief, said one of the mantras for firemen is never trust a truss. And that those trusses seem to be a nightmare in a fire.
Are you aware that on the 13th of February 1975 there was a massive fire in the North Tower on the 11th floor?
Yes.
That enveloped three quarters of the floor, that burned around 2,000 degrees for 3 hours, and yet the steel, including the trusses, survived no serious damage. They did not have to replace any of the trusses.
Well, you know what's very interesting about that? I am aware of that, and one thought I've had about that is the lower part of the building had asbestos insulation. And asbestos, to be honest, although it's terrible stuff in terms of environmental and health impacts, it is the best sort of fire protection known to man, and that lower part of the building had that. And in fact, I believe when they ruled, they banned the asbestos halfway through the construction, someone famously said, well, I hope they never have a fire in the upper section of this building, because I wouldn't want to be around if that happened.
But bear in mind, Frank, I mean, historically that seems like a ridiculous observation. No steel structure, no heavy steel structure has ever collapsed due to fire alone in the history of structural engineering.
But no steel structure has been plowed into by two aircraft traveling at 500 miles an hour.
Which appear to have had negligible damage. We'll be right back with my special guest, Frank Greening. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. Today, my special guest is Dr. Frank Greening, a physical chemist with a great deal of experience, and we're discussing the destruction of the Twin Towers. Frank, just to return to this issue about the towers, let me just ask a preliminary question. William Rodriguez, of course, who was the senior custodian in the North Tower, reported that there was a massive explosion in the sub-basements there that he said even occurred before planes impacted with the building. Craig Furlong and Gordon Ross have, in fact, pursued that issue and discovered, based upon rather exact seismological data from a laboratory maintained by Columbia University and very exact FAA and radar data, that those explosions appear to have occurred as much as 14 to 17 seconds before the plane hit the building. Is that consistent with your understanding?
Yeah, I'm familiar with that work, and the only thing I can say about that is if they claim there was a seismological signal from an explosion, then there should have been a second one from the impact. But there was only one seismic signal, so I'm not sure what's going on there.
Well, the early seismological recordings were 0.7 and 0.9 on the Richter scale, and then of course when the devastation of the buildings took place, they were 2.1 and 2.3 on the Richter scale. The impact of the planes itself at 80 floors or 96 floors is most unlikely to cause any seismological effect, or are you implying to the contrary?
No, first of all, I'm not a seismologist, so but based on what I've read about this, I have no problem with the planes causing a seismic signal. And the other interesting thing is, if there was this alleged bomb in the basement, the most famous bomb in the basement of the World Trade Center was the 1993 bombing, and that was one huge bomb. It did incredible damage, and it didn't leave a seismic signal.
That's a wonderful point, Frank, because it seems to me it raises, you know, extreme questions as to why the impact of the planes would do that. On the other hand, if these were intended to dislodge the foundation, say, the 47 core columns from the bedrock, then it would be expected that it would have a seismic signal. And I think your example of the 93 bombing is quite fascinating in this respect.
Yeah, well, I've looked into this as much as I can, but I think people need to be very careful interpreting seismographic data, and if they're not seismologists, and I'm not a seismologist, and I think this is one of the problems with 9/11 research, is that people dibble dabble in areas where they're not really experts and reach erroneous conclusions.
Well, let me ask you this. William Rodriguez reported that a fellow custodian had, you know, a lot of the skin blown off his body, I mean, from this explosion, was hanging down. There was a 50-ton hydraulic press. I take it that doesn't mean the press weighed 50 tons, but that it was capable of exerting 50 tons of force. And there was a tremendous amount of damage to the lobby. Is it your inclination to attribute that to the jet plane impact and jet fuel falling through elevators or something such?
Well, that's the interpretation I've seen. To be honest, this is why I call myself still a 9/11 agnostic, because there are some of these areas where things are not completely kosher, you know? So that's one.
Suppose, and I think this, you know, this is easily determinable, the staircases are staggered, so at the 78th and the 44th floor, you have to actually get off and go on to other elevators. If there are only two elevators that go the entire extent of the building. And then in the case of the North Tower, a fellow custodian of William Rodriguez was in one of those elevators with a broken leg. And if there had been a jet fuel that had come down and exploded, he would have been killed, and yet he survived. If everything I've just described is true, doesn't that tend to undermine the claim that these events in the sub-basements could have had anything to do at all with the jet fuel fire?
These are areas that for me are gray, but this is the trouble with a lot of these is they're based on anecdotal information, and as a scientist, it's like, I'm not denying these people didn't see these things, but as a scientist, they're hard to deal with in comparison to a chemical analysis that shows this, that, or the other, or that kind of hard evidence. I prefer to work with the hard evidence.
Well,
evidence.
Yes, I agree. We want to integrate, you know, witness reports with the so-called hard evidence, including especially the physical evidence and also the photographic evidence and so forth, and come up with the most coherent integration, the most adequate explanation, which may imply that some of the witnesses were mistaken or that some of the photographic evidence was altered or whatnot. That's certainly been the case in relation to, you know, investigation of the death of JFK. Let's go back to the 80th and the 96th floors, where you have these rather modest fires burning around 500 degrees. In the case of the South Tower, for less than an hour. In the case of the North Tower, for about an hour and a half. Is it your submission that those fires burn long enough or intensely enough to cause the steel to weaken?
I believe that they would have, in pockets, they would have weakened the steel. And the other point that I think is very important is that the damage was asymmetrical. And this, because if you look at the collapse, both towers, there is this tipping of the upper section. It's very pronounced and easy to see in World Trade Center 2, but even World Trade Center 1, because of the antenna, acts as a nice kind of marker. It wobbles around all over the place as that block descends. So the tipping is very, very crucial to the mode of collapse.
Well, suppose, as I would conjecture, some relatively conventional explosives were used, say, at the beginning and at the end of these demolition sequences. But let's just talk about the beginning as much as we can. I mean, it seems, so far as I can tell, that the problem with the NIST report, and you have offered a number of criticisms thereof, which I find quite fascinating, is that it never really gets us to an actual genuine initiation point. Let's talk about this when we return. This is my special guest, Frank Greening. Today, my special guest is Frank Greening, a physical chemist with a great deal of experience, and we're talking about what happened, the devastation of the World Trade Center buildings, the Twin Towers, WTC 1 and 2. Frank, something I liked about this post of yours on the Randy forum was that you were talking about the theories that were available and the basic phenomena that you considered they have to account for. The theories, the way you broke them down, were, of course, the official theory, planes, trains, and automobiles, gravitational fires, and all that. Then Steve Jones' use of thermite and possibly RDX, what have you. And then third, of course, Judy Wood's work proposing the idea that some kind of non-conventional source of energy may have been involved here. But perhaps directed energy in some form. It seems to me useful to sort out the Jones theory as appealing to conventional modes of demolition. The Wood theory is talking about non-conventional, and that this is a really important divide, not just scientifically, but also politically, because these conventional kinds of explosives, if that's all that was involved, can be purchased on places like eBay, and apart from, say, this RDX, which I take it has a chemical signature in its residue that enables you to determine its source of manufacture, none of which, to the best of my knowledge, has ever been identified, those still don't uniquely point in any particular direction as to who might be responsible. On the other hand, if we're talking about mini nukes, atomic or hydrogen, micro weapons, what have you, lasers, masers, plasmoids, what have you, that most certainly points in the direction of a very limited number of sources, namely, I would suggest the military-industrial complex. They're talking about high-tech weapons, almost certainly having their origin in the Star Wars research program intended to take out ballistic missiles fired through space, and which has led to the development of a huge array of directed energy weapons and lasers, which were being tested as long ago as 1991. A ground-based laser was deflected off of a mirror on a satellite in space back to a target on Earth, and of course the HART project, which is intended to deliver something like 3.6 gigawatts of energy at any particular location. I mean, all this stuff to me is quite fascinating, and while, to the best of my knowledge, Judy has never committed herself to one or another, she certainly believes that the explanation has to be found in this direction. I'm inclined to agree with her. But what I want to ask about now is your view. You have identified these five properties you think have to be accounted for, namely the sudden onset of the collapse of each tower, the near freefall descent of a block of floors above each impact zone, pulverization and ejection of concrete during the collapse, the completeness of the destruction of each tower, and the sustained high temperatures in the bubble pile long after 9/11. So what I'm interested in asking, Frank, is how you would say the official theory, for example, fares in relation to those five points you've enumerated without challenging any of them, if we accept them as five crucial points. How does the official theory fare in relation to them?
Well, the trouble with the official theory is it doesn't even address a whole bunch of those, because it stops short once it with its famous mantra, global collapse ensues. At the moment that NIST argued that the building was now doomed, it had entered some state where it was starting to collapse. But I find it kind of amazing that the NIST scientists sort of washed their hands of it at that point and said, well, our work here is done. We can go home. I mean, it's like as those buildings collapsed and we're watching on the TV, we just turn the TV off and say, oh, well, those buildings are toast. And to me, that's a shame. And I'm not very scientific. Now the rubble pile seems to be off limits. And I go on these websites like JREF and PhysOrg, and these people come on, and their argument is that was not part of NIST's mandate. That, you know, they did their job, and then there was nothing more to say. And I just don't accept that argument.
So, if you take a look at the recent requests for clarification submitted by Ed Haas, Morgan Reynolds, and Judy Wood, you'll find, in fact, the NIST mandate was to explain how all this happened, which they manifestly have not done. So, in fact, they have failed to satisfy their mandate, no matter what additional questions might be raised about the quality of the evidence or the scientific seriousness of their inquiry.
Yeah, well, they obviously made the decision probably at a high level that this is where they would take their investigation and they wouldn't go any further. And as I say, I think a lot of what they did was very, very good. The parts of the report are really excellent, in my opinion, and I don't want to come across as that I'm bashing NIST scientists, because I'm a scientist and I respect their work. But I feel there was some conscious decision made not to get into these other areas, maybe because they're so controversial. And the one that, of course, I find fascinating is the sustained heat of the rubble pile.
Well, I want to come to that, but may I infer that in relation to these five desiderata, these properties that you believe need to be accounted for, that NIST does not fare very well. It doesn't address them or it doesn't explain them.
Correct, yes.
Then the second alternative is Jones thermite hypothesis. And I'm saying, well, let's toss in other conventional modes of explosives to round it out. How well do you think that approach fares in relation to these considerations?
Well, it because it focuses more on the aftermath, it does reasonably well, but I have lots of problems with it in terms of the logistics of how it could be set up. In what would happen to pre-planted explosives in the event of planes smashing into the buildings, what it would do to the detonators, to the wiring, all those kinds of questions, and the lack of evidence really in the rubble pile. I know Stephen Jones claims that there's some evidence, things like sulfur residues, but I've looked into that, and there's so many sources of sulfur. To get excited about finding sulfur in the rubble pile just doesn't cut it, because, as I say, right off the bat, there's calcium sulfate in the gypsum. So while, you know, it has some plausibility, I feel it falls short in terms of evidence. Unless you're going to start arguing that there were some men in black going over the rubble pile confiscating all the key evidence. And I don't think that. There were too many people there, genuine rescue workers, for people to be tampering with the evidence to that degree. Someone should have found some evidence, detonator wire, and the residues, and analysis of the dust should have shown more evidence than I think Stephen Jones has presented.
To the best of my knowledge, the patents in this area include some for thermite or thermate that's capable of destroying 2 inches of steel, since the main support columns at the base, although they tapered from there upward, were 4 inches thick, and of course they eventually become only 1/4 inch thick toward the top. But it would seem to be particularly problematic if you'd have to, you know, position this kind of cutter charge on both sides of those steel beams. I mean, that seems to be highly problematic.
Exactly.
We'll be right back with my special guest, Frank Greene, physical chemist with a great deal of experience. We're talking about research he's conducted on the demolition of the Twin Towers. Frank, I'm very, very happy to have you on today. I'm simply delighted. The additional theory, of course, we haven't considered yet is the idea that unconventional sources of energy, directed energy, whatnot, and it covers a broad range of alternatives, may have been involved. Would you like to address what you have found in terms of, for example, Judy Wood's work?
Sure. The problem I have with Judy Wood's theory, I mean, it's a nice theory, but there's logistical problems, as there are with Stephen Jones's theory, namely, in the case of her theory, the amount of energy required. For example, I've seen posters claim that, you know, the north wall of the North Tower was vaporized and dustified, words like that. Well, let's just say it was 10% of the steel in the building. That's, say, 9,000 tons. You work out, just from, as a chemist, you can work out the energy requirement to turn that, to vaporize that, to convert it from solid to liquid to gas. It's an incredible amount of energy. I came up with something, like, imagine this gadget is turned on during the collapse, during the destruction for, say, 10 seconds. It would require 50 nuclear power stations running flat out.
Well, let me just offer a counterexample, because I've heard those kinds of arguments from other sources. I mean, you've seen photographs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Sure.
And those were relatively modest nuclear weapons at the time. I mean, it seems to me a single atomic bomb could have done this kind of damage. And it's not, it's not five times the Earth's energy, as some have suggested.
That's exaggeration, sure.
Yeah, completely ridiculous. But it does seem, in terms of the effects, that we need vastly more energy. I mean, Paul Craig Roberts has summarized it very well in one of his commentaries, that the problem with the official account seems to be a massive energy deficit in terms of account for even the five key points you make, especially the completeness of destruction, the pulverization and injection of concrete, not to mention the near free fall descent. So, I mean, don't you think we do need to go somewhere, but we don't have an hypothesis from either the conventional direction or from the official account that can do this, so that in terms of research looking at non-conventional sources, that's a very plausible direction to search. Research is ongoing here, no conclusions are predetermined, but it would seem to me that's a perfectly appropriate approach to adopt.
Well, I mean, I'm happy to see people looking into these questions, because they're fascinating, and I don't like this idea that this sort of research should be suppressed, as Bush's famous, you know, we will not tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories. This is research, and in the home of the brave and the land of the free, I think people should be allowed to investigate this without being attacked or told that it will not be tolerated. But having said that, I do believe that the energy requirements are largely met by the potential energy stored in the building, with a few strange anomalies that need to be sorted out, like the production of some molten iron in the building, things like that.
How about some of the oddities in the remnants, you know, the enormous gouge out of Building 6, these cookie-cutter kinds of holes in Building 5, the half complete decimation of Building 4 with half remaining, the enormous gouge in Building 3. Aren't those phenomena that are very challenging to any of the accounts?
Sure, but I haven't looked that closely into them. And again, this is where I feel NIST could have kept going with their investigation, because I'd like to know, for example, where, based on their theory, they think the antenna landed, and that would tell us. I mean, they found the antenna in the rubble pile, and I'd like to know if that location is consistent with the NIST model, the trajectory of the upper section. it seemed to be tipping and moving off in some kind of direction, the destruction of the Winter Garden over right across the West Street is quite remarkable. So I think we do need to keep investigating those questions for sure. But I don't know if exotic weaponry is the answer.
Have you paid any attention to the toasted car phenomenon? You know, some 1,400 cars suffered weird kinds of damage. Half of them, the engine block might be destroyed, but the back half is pristine and the gasoline tank hasn't exploded.
Yeah, I've seen that. That one is strange too. And again, it's a stretch to go from there to exotic microwave weaponry, I'm afraid, because we're getting into sort of sci-fi movie scripts at this point, and I want to stay focused. I mean, an interesting phenomena is crop circles, and they find strange things in crop circles.
Just the physics of the Twin Towers, though, Frank, wouldn't you agree? I mean, if we have effects here that are strange and anomalous, that we're going to have to take seriously hypotheses that might explain them. It turns out, you know, directed energy has been around for quite a while. There's a professional directed energy society that had been meeting already like for 10 years back in 2004 when I was doing research on the cause of the crash that took the life of Senator Paul Wellstone. I mean, this is very well established, and the fact that you or I might not know a lot about it doesn't mean there isn't a tremendous amount of knowledge out there possessed by the appropriate experts. Would you concede as much?
No, I agree. I'm saying, but because some of this is sort of obviously classified, it leaves the scientists like myself at a loss to pursue research in that area. I like to stick with what I know. And use the laws of physics and chemistry and the collapse, you know, as a collapse, and see if I can analyze it that way first.
If you can, yes. And I take it that it's the absence of sufficient energy to cause all of these effects that has led you to introduce a new theory, namely that the towers were somehow pre-primed with ammonium percolate. Would you care to elaborate on that?
Oh, well, that was just my attempt to show that, you know, you two can come up with a conspiracy theory. And I felt that if I was an evildoer and I was going to take down those towers, that would be a rather novel way to do it. You could spike the insulation and no one would know, and it would just sit there. You don't need any wires. You don't need any detonators. It's activated by heat, and then it becomes rocket fuel. And it could account for some of the observations, including the massive amounts of hydrochloric acid that were released from the rubble pile, although I'm sure a lot of that came from PVC decomposition. So I offered this as an example of we can put out these theories, but who's to say which is true?
But as you may know, I'm organizing a conference for 2 to 4 August here in Madison to discuss these controversial issues. There are going to be a smaller number of much longer sessions. And I like your spirit and attitude. I'd like to invite you to be a speaker there to participate in a discussion of these issues with Judy Wood. I'd like to have the two of you discuss and debate these issues and present and assess the evidence. And I would be glad to provide your transportation, accommodations, and registration. So I'd like for you to pencil that in on your calendar, Frank.
You say August 2nd?
Uh-huh, 2nd through 4th.
Well, let me get back to you on it, but I appreciate the offer, and it sounds very interesting, and I'd love to come, but I have to make sure that, you know, my family and my, you know, personal affairs are all taken care of.
Frank Green, I'm delighted to have had you on the program together. It's been wonderful. I'll have to have you back. This is Jim Fetzer. This has been the Dynamic Duo. Thank you all for listening.